was much of a private time.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 16th. Hope you all had a restful weekend. Today we've got two bills up concerning collection agencies, Senate Bill 328 and House Bill 2300. And I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 328 first. Victoria, can you give us a summary of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 328 subjects persons who engage in unlawful collections practices to the provisions of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act.
Thank you. And were there any amendments to this bill on the Senate side?
No.
Thank you. So up first, we have sponsors of the bill from the Department of Justice, the Attorney General, John Kroger, and from his department, Keith Dubanovich. I hope I pronounced your name right.
Close enough.
Dubanovich.
Thank you, sir.
You're getting closer all the time, though.
That's right. Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You. Thank you.
John Kroger, Attorney General of Oregon.
Excuse the noise. Hopefully we have our phones and instruments of mechanical and electronic devices on silent, if nothing else. And our phones off. Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for allowing me to testify today. I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 328, which was introduced, sponsored by my department. It's the only bill in this legislature with my name on it, and that's not an accident. As Attorney General, my focus is obviously not on trying to change the law, but simply to enforce the laws that we've got. But this particular area of violation of debt collection practices law is really a troubling area in Oregon law right now, and one which I feel we need to address. If you look at the complaints that the Oregon Department of Justice receives from consumers, one of our highest areas and one of our largest areas of growth is in debt collection practices, debt collection agencies engaging in unfair and sometimes outrageous conduct in their effort to collect debts. I should be very clear that I believe profoundly that when people borrow money, they should pay it back. But when they get behind in their bills, and unfortunately that's going to happen even more in the current recession, that does not justify companies violating the law. The debt collection area has been regulated since the 1970s by the Debt Collection Practices Act, which provides a list of things that companies cannot do when they try to collect debts, things like calling in the middle of the night, threatening to call an employer to disclose the failure to repay a loan, use of abusive language or other kinds of threats. And unfortunately, we're seeing just that kind of conduct with increasing frequency in Oregon. The reason I think we are in this position is very simple. Right now, there's no effective way to hold companies accountable when they violate the Debt Collection Practices Act. There is a private right of action, but there is no possibility of state action. My office is on the sidelines and cannot enforce the debt collection practices law. Unfortunately, I think a lot of the big national companies that are involved in debt collection know this. About three-quarters of our complaints are from out-of-state companies that engage in these kind of outrageous pressure tactics to try to collect debts. And we have no effective tool to go after those companies and hold them accountable when they violate the law. Senate Bill 328 will repair that. It won't change the legal burden on companies at all. All they will be required to do is what they were required to do since the 1970s, comply with the Debt Collection Practices Act. However, it will allow the state to take legal action if the company does violate current law by making a violation of the Debt Collection Practices Act a violation of our state's Unfair Trade Practices Act. This is a very reasonable response to the problem. A very similar approach has been adopted in California and in Washington. It's also a moderate response. I would compare it to Texas, where they've made violation of the debt collection laws a criminal violation. This would simply make it a civil violation with the possibility of a civil lawsuit if a company violated the law. I will tell the committee that if we're granted this power, we would use it responsibly. We will go after the companies that are the biggest problems, the ones that have the largest number of violations, the ones that have engaged in the most outrageous tactics, the ones that are clearly engaged in intentional misconduct rather than accidental one-time mistakes. This bill has been endorsed by a number of the editorial boards around the state. It received a very strong measure of bipartisan support, and we would urge the committee to take action on it. I'm now going to pass the microphone, if I could, to Mr. Dubanovich, Special Counsel at the Department of Justice.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Since 2001, the number of complaints that we've received about debt collection agencies.
And excuse me, if you would identify yourself for the record, even though your boss does, you still have to do it.
I apologize, Chair. My name is Keith Dubanovich, Special Counsel to the Attorney General, Department of Justice. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, since 2001, the number of complaints that the Department of Justice has received about debt collection agencies has repeatedly placed the industry in the top 10 on our consumer complaint list. During 2008, we received 1,088 written consumer complaints. And now those are just written complaints. We also obviously receive a number of telephone calls that are also complaints about debt collection practices. Now, based on our experience, we know that a lot of consumers never file complaints, and indeed many consumers may not be aware that the conduct that they experience by receiving a telephone call in the evening or at their place of work, they may not be aware that that conduct is illegal. So as a consequence, in our view, the number of complaints that we get is probably an underestimation of the number of wrongful acts in the state. Now, it's worth noting that the Federal Trade Commission gets more complaints about the debt collection industry than any other industry. And indeed, the National Association of Attorneys General ranks debt collection complaints as the number one in their collection of consumer complaints. What I'd like to do is give you some examples of the complaints that we receive, describe to you a little bit about what the Debt Collection Practices Act does, and explain why we believe that we should be allowed to use the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to enforce the Debt Collection Practices Law. In 2008, we received a complaint from a mother who wrote on behalf of her 25-year-old developmentally disabled son. They had received some threatening calls at home about a debt that was from a telephone call that was made to their phone in 1998. Now, their son, who was developmentally disabled, was concerned that the debt collectors were going to come and put him in jail. And the consumers had disputed the validity of the debt, and finally one collection agency dropped it, but of course a week later they started getting calls from another collection agency. We've received threats of verbal abuse, including threats of violence and very disrespectful statements and profanity. And we've received complaints from a consumer who got repeated calls on a debt that he had clearly paid. And when he provided proof of the payment, another collection company started calling him a week later. So those are the examples of the complaints that we got. And in 2008, again, it's 1,088 written complaints that the department has received. And as the Attorney General said, with a worsening economy, we can anticipate that the number of complaints will increase. Now, as the Attorney General said, the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act is not a relief from debt. It's not a way out for people to avoid having to pay their debts. What it is it's a regulation that governs how you can approach a debtor and ask them to pay. And this is a law that this legislature passed a number of years ago, and it's very similar to an act that was passed by the U.S. Congress. Indeed, back in 1977, the congressional committee that was looking at this law said that debt collection abuse by third-party debt collectors is widespread and a serious national problem. Unfortunately, this problem has gotten worse, and one of the reasons is because companies that buy thousands of accounts, they're now called debt buyers, they're often unregulated, and that is precisely the situation in the state of Oregon. Our Department of Business and Consumer Services does not regulate debt buyers. And as a consequence, whatever they do in the state of Oregon is completely free and clear of any kind of law enforcement. So what is illegal under the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act? Well, misrepresenting the character or amount or legal status of a debt, harassing the debtor is obviously illegal, threatening dire consequences such as throwing somebody in jail, calling their place of employment if it interferes with their job, disclosing a debt to your neighbors, and continuing to contact the consumer after the consumer has specifically said, please do not contact me anymore. Those things are illegal. But if done in the state of Oregon, there is no law enforcement entity that has the power to enforce our regulations. That's why we're here to ask this committee to approve Senate Bill 328 so that we can use the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to go after companies that violate our law. Now, as this committee is well aware, the UTPA has a long list of statutory violations, and in that list are a lot of cross-references to other statutes. We've made it a violation of the UTPA to violate other state statutes, and all we're trying to do is cross-reference in the UTPA, the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. Now, uniquely, there are very few number of industries that are not subject to the UTPA enforcement mechanisms. The mortgage lending industry and debt collectors and the insurance industry, and that's pretty much it. Now, the Federal Trade Commission has said in its most recent report to Congress that vigorous federal and state law enforcement in this area is essential. And what we are seeking to do is to be given the tools to enforce the law. Now, the Department of Consumer and Business Services does not enforce the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. While they regulate debt collection services companies, their primary focus is on the relationship between the debt collection entity and the people that they are working for, the people who are owed the debt. DCBS does not enforce the Debt Collection Practices Act. Now, there are a lot of states, including most of our neighbors, that already give attorneys general the power to enforce their state debt collection practices act. For example, the states of Washington, New York, Massachusetts, Texas, New Hampshire, Michigan, Florida, Montana, Maryland, Hawaii, Illinois, California, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina all give their attorneys general the power to enforce the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act through their Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And we are asking for the exact same power and authority that the attorneys general in those states have. And as Attorney General Kroger said, the state of Texas even says that a violation of their state's debt collection practices law is punishable as a misdemeanor, a criminal violation. Now, we're not looking to criminalize debt collection practices in this state, but we are seeking to use our primary consumer statute, the UTPA, so that we can go after illegal debt collection practices. Simply put, we're seeking to level the playing field. We know that there are a large number of very legitimate debt collectors in this state that are complying with the law. Unfortunately, they're having to compete with companies from New York, and even debt collection people that are making telephone calls from India. And unless we can enforce the law against those companies, the companies that are complying with our law, companies here in Oregon, they will have a very difficult time competing against the foreign entities that are not complying with our law. Now, Senate Bill 328 does not create any new regulations. It creates no new bureaucracy because we are already set up to handle and process consumer complaints. And through the use of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, we will be able to cover whatever expense that we might incur in enforcing the statute. As a consequence, Senate Bill 328 has no fiscal impact on the state of Oregon. I would be welcome to answer any of your questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I wanted to know is, you know, there must be other businesses where you regulate and do enforcement from with companies that don't are not Oregon companies under this act. Is that true?
That's correct. It's very common for us to engage in litigation against companies that are based outside of the state but violate the law within the state. And I would note, particularly in the debt collection area, there are currently underway both one major lawsuit and several investigations where attorneys general from around the country are working together to go after some of the larger companies with a national practice and a long track record of violating the law. And unfortunately, I can't join in those multi-state litigation efforts because we don't have the authority. And so we would have the authority were this bill to pass, and that would give us an important tool to help hold some of these larger companies accountable.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
Thank you. And what about international?
You know, the Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, those are more challenging cases. As you're aware, the legal process for a state to go after a foreign-based company is often a little more difficult. However, most of those companies are licensed to operate somewhere in the United States. So it's not as if we're going after, say, scam artists that are based in the Philippines or Nigeria. Usually those companies have a U.S. presence and are outsourcing. So if you've got a call center that's based overseas, in most circumstances there will be a local U.S. Presence that we can take legal action against.
Thank you for those answers.
Other questions? Representative Krieger.
Got some written material that seems to have a little bit of difference to it. Can you tell me how many companies are registered in Oregon debt companies outside of the state compared to inside of the state?
Chair Holvey, Representative Krieger, I don't have that information off the top of my head. I could tell you that three-quarters of our complaints are against out-of-state companies, and one-quarter of our complaints approximately are against companies that are based in the state.
Follow-up. Do you recall what year it was Oregon allowed out-of-states not to have presence and records in Oregon? They're allowed to stay outside of the state. When did that happen, do you know?
Chair Holvey, Representative Krieger, I don't have that date off the top of my head. I believe it was a decision by DCBS to take that route. And, you know, I don't think that's the significant problem here. I think the problem is that this has become a national business for many of these big companies. And quite frankly, these companies know that there's no enforcement here in Oregon, and that makes it very difficult to police their efforts.
Just one follow-up.
Follow-up.
What would be the typical type of enforcement action you'd take against an out-of-state, so I understand what you can do? You said it's not criminal.
Chair Holvey, Representative Krieger, we would start typically with simply a letter to the company informing them that we've received complaints and that we would expect them to change their conduct. That could be followed up by litigation against a company, particularly if the company is one that has a long track record of violating the law. If a letter doesn't do the trick, then we would move toward litigation.
And what would that subject them to?
It would subject them to two things under the UTPA. One is the possibility of an injunction enjoining them from engaging in certain practices, and second, the possibility of a civil fine that would hopefully help change their behavior by hitting them in the pocketbook.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Cowan.
Thank you. The question that has come up, and I guess that I'm wrestling with, maybe I would be interested in your perspective on it, is that as we talk about the options, I think that generally everyone is in agreement that there should be a crackdown on entities that are not following fair debt collection practices. And the discussion seems to be whether that should be regulated more heavily under DCBS or under your office. And the concern that I've heard raised is that the opportunity to pull licenses, which has been was put to me as being a death notice for inappropriate acting companies, as opposed to fines. And so I'd be interested in your take on how do we get the most enforcement? Is it through licensure or is it through fine? What I want is these practices to stop.
Chair Holvey, Representative Cowan, I feel very comfortable telling you that if my office were given this power, we would exercise it thoughtfully and responsibly, but also aggressively to make sure that these practices end. The UTPA is a very, very good enforcement tool. It's one we're very used to working with. It applies already to roughly 99% of the companies in the states. So what we're doing here is effectively closing a loophole that exists that has allowed unlawful behavior to take root. And when I think about the options, I would simply note that the choice of a regulatory response would come with new regulations. It would come with new employees at a time when the state is facing significant budget challenges and would come with a significant fiscal impact. Senate Bill 328 comes with no impact, in part because we're already spending resources without having the proper enforcement tools. When my office gets these complaints, we already send letters to the companies informing them that we're aware of the complaints. We're hoping that a simple letter from the Department of Justice, even though it's not backed up by significant enforcement capability, will have some impact on the individual case. So we're already doing this work. That's why there won't be a significant fiscal impact. In fact, there's a finding of no fiscal impact for this bill. I think if the committee is serious about ending this problem, a law enforcement response rather than a regulatory response would be the appropriate way to go.
If I can add, Chair Holvey, Representative Cowan, presently there are entities called first-party debt collection entities and debt buyers. They are not licensed or regulated by any type of state government entity. So as a consequence, a threat to pull their license is of no value. And debt buyers and first-party debt collectors are increasing in the percentage of complaints that we get from these companies. So as a consequence, unless 328 is passed and the Department of Justice is given authority to go after those entities, DCBS would simply be unable to do anything against them. And so under the UTPA, not only do we have the power to impose fines, but we can stop them from doing business in the state of Oregon with a license or not. We have the power to prevent them from doing any business in this state.
Thank you. I want you to clarify something from Gibson Cowan brought up a point that is weighing the regulation by DCBS versus the enforcement of practices by the Attorney General's office. And I think there is a distinction there that needs to be made clear. So it's my understanding, as far as DCBS having regulatory authority, they essentially look at the business and its, I guess, procedures and whether they're registered and, you know, those sorts of things, but really don't enforce any practices as they directly relate to the consumer. And so is that relatively correct, or can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Chair Holvey, yes, that is correct. DCBS licenses debt collection companies and takes complaints from large companies like Sears that might contact a debt collection agency and arrange for the agency to collect debts on behalf of Sears, but they don't handle, or process, or respond to complaints from consumers about the actions of the debt collection agencies themselves. And that is why taking a DCBS-based approach, you'd have to come up with new regulations, hire new employees to handle these complaints, set up a new process, whereas the Department of Justice is already prepared to hit the ground running and to do this work. I might also add that DCBS supports Senate Bill 328. This is not one of those cases where there's a turf battle between agencies.
And clarify for me as well the issue of the out-of-state collection agency right now. I think they still have to be registered with the state, but as far as DCBS being able to regulate their practices, just as they don't regulate the practices in relationship to the consumer in state, the Senate Bill 328 would give you the ability to regulate their practices as when they do business with people in the state of Oregon?
Chair Holvey, yes, we would be able to take appropriate enforcement action not only against companies inside the state that are licensed in the state or companies from outside the state licensed to operate here, but unlicensed companies, as well as companies that aren't required to register, such as first-party debt collectors and the so-called debt buyer organizations that are increasing in this area. So this is a little more flexible enforcement tool. I also have to say that given that three-quarters of the complaints are from companies outside of the state, what you want is a powerful enforcement tool to make it clear to these companies that unlawful practices inside our state are not appropriate and will be responded to. And the Unfair Trade Practices Act has a very strong reputation and gives us the tools we need to make sure that some of these larger out-of-state companies understand that we're serious about this problem.
And I have one more question before I move on to somebody else. So there's also been the discussion about these companies, you know, losing their licenses for their practices, and this bill does not give you the authority to do that, but it's my understanding that DCBS does have that authority, and this bill wouldn't remove that authority from them to, I guess, take somebody's license or authorization to work in the state away.
Chair Holvey, yes, that's correct. DCBS would still retain all of their traditional power. I might note that it is my understanding that they've never taken a license from a company based on a consumer complaint, though it's conceivable that they could in the future. I would say that under the Unfair Trade Practices Act, we do have the power to prohibit companies from operating in the state. We'll be quite honest with you, my goal is not to stop companies from doing business. My goal is not to put anyone out of business, but I do think that companies operating in the state should follow the laws of the state.
Thank you. Representative Matthews?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Good to see you here today. I guess my question, we've gotten a few emails, and I talked to Ben the other day, and you and I have talked before. I've just gotten a few constituent responses and a couple of things I think you can probably help clarify. You had said, I think it was you in your testimony, that you were out to look for the intentional versus the accidental misconduct, and I believe that's true. But I think what's hanging over the head of folks is it $25,000 the civil fine that could be up to and including $25,000 and unlawful? Okay. So I think what's concerning people is that how do we distinguish, or how do they know that if it's an accidental misconduct, they violate the law, not intentionally, just accidentally, how do they know that that first time impact isn't going to be $25,000? And I just, you know, I asked the question just to try to get the answer back for folks.
Representative Matthews, Chair Holvey,
Representative, the simple thing I would tell you is that this is a statute which we use day in and day out at the Department of Justice, and I am deeply committed to making sure that it's used responsibly. To that end, I have offered to Mr. Marquis, who represents the debt collection agencies here in the state, to sit down with him once a week, if necessary, if this law is implemented, to make sure that our enforcement actions are taken responsibly and thoughtfully. I can tell you, as a professional prosecutor, I would be very vigilant in halting any enforcement action where a one-time accidental mistake by a company resulted in a $25,000 fine. What we are interested in is taking appropriate law enforcement action, and that means that the size of the fine would depend on a number of factors, including the nature of the conduct, how egregious it is, whether it's intentional or accidental, whether it's part of a long-term pattern, whether it occurred after a prior warning to stop, and in some cases the size of the company itself, because you're trying to determine what size of fine will have a sufficient deterrent impact on misconduct in the future. Those are the factors that certainly will govern our conduct generally under the Unfair Trade Practices Act, and more specifically if this legislation is approved in its application to debt collectors. And certainly I would be willing to sit down with any company in the state that feels it's being incorrectly targeted by the UTPA, because quite frankly our goal with the Department of Justice is justice, and if someone thinks that we're doing something improper, I would want to know about that and sit down with them immediately.
Chair Holvey, Representative Matthews, if I can add, the fact of the matter is that in very, very few circumstances has a court, not just the Department of Justice, but a court actually imposed a $25,000 penalty. The Department of Justice does not have the ability nor the right to unilaterally say, we're going to charge you $25,000. That's a process that occurs only after litigation is filed and after a judge looks at the evidence and then imposes a civil money penalty. A vast majority of the complaints that come to us are resolved through an amicable discussion with the company, and we enter into what's called an assurance of voluntary compliance. And basically, it's an agreement between the Department of Justice and the company that they voluntarily enter into, and it does not result in a fine or a penalty pursuant to the UTPA.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Chair. John, I appreciate this bill and you bringing it forward and everything, and it went through. I agree with everything that you're trying to do here. I'm just wondering, did you get a chance to look at the minority report that came over from the Senate side? Because I was kind of going through that, and it looks pretty good, and I just wondering if you would still be able to achieve the goals that you're wanting to. I notice it reduces some of the amounts and everything, but I'm just kind of wondering what your feeling is on it.
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, I think that our goals here are very straightforward, which is to have a very simple and transparent process by applying the UTPA to these kinds of violations. Throughout this process, I've been very willing to try to come to a compromise which I thought would be acceptable to the debt collection agencies as well, and unfortunately that process simply didn't work out. Some of the proposals which we received were, in my view, unconstitutional, and thus I could not recommend that they be adopted by the legislature. Others, quite frankly, because they have a significant fiscal impact, I think are, quite frankly, designed to kill off an effort to pass a bill rather than to make sure that the law is enforced. So I think at the end of the day, Senate Bill 328 received the support not only of all of the Democrats in the Senate, but a significant number of the Republicans as well. And I think that's because it fits in with the scheme of law enforcement that we have in the state currently, whereby, like I said, about 99% of the companies in the state are required to comply with the Unfair Trade Practices Act.
Yeah. Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. I just have a couple of questions. I want to understand this. When a debt collector is engaging in some of the practices that were outlined in your letter. You said you currently send them a letter. Can you give me some idea of, under what authority you send that letter and what basically will you communicate to the debt collector, you know, what your authority is to be contacting them, and essentially what's the threat that you're making in your letter currently?
Chair Holvey, Representative Wingert, I think the easiest thing to do would simply be to submit to you a copy of the letter that we send to companies so that you'll be able to see the specific language that we send. What we inform companies in general is that we've received an allegation that violates the Debt Collection Practices Act and could violate the UTPA's unconscionability provision. This is the provision that applies to all companies in the state. The problem with trying to enforce the unconscionability provisions of the statute is that it's such a vague term. Businesses don't know what they're allowed to do or not do, and so I'm very uncomfortable proceeding in that manner. Quite frankly, I would strongly prefer to be able to send a letter that says we have clear enforcement authority rather than the letter we're sending now.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
I have to say that the stories told in your handout feel unconscionable to me. So I guess I'm wondering how many times you have brought action under that statute, and if it's not at all, why you hesitate to push this issue? And I mean, one of the ways we get definition of terms is through litigation. I'm not the lawyer here. You are, but these things get defined through the process of litigation, do they not?
Chair Holvey, Representative Wingert, I will tell you that as a prosecutor, I'm uncomfortable with the idea of asking companies to comply with a conscionability versus unconscionability requirement. I mean, quite frankly, I think it's always best to have clear rules, and that's what the Unfair Debt Collection Practices Act provides, is very clear rules about what companies can and cannot do. I'm not familiar of any litigation in the past under the unconscionability prong, but I can't say that there haven't been. As you know, I've been Attorney General for 2 months, so I don't know whether there's been one in the past. But I can tell you that if the committee is interested in ensuring that companies do not routinely violate Oregon law in the future, that Senate Bill 328 is an effective tool to do that, and absent that, we're not going to be able to address this problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? I appreciate you coming forward and bringing this bill forward. It's an issue that's been in this legislature for quite some time, and I guess I had one thing in following up with Representative Wingert. I'm wondering, and also Representative Matthews' questions, I'm wondering, does the Attorney General's office, and you probably wouldn't know this, have any kind of records on what percentage of UTPA violations are prosecuted with the full $25,000 fine compared, what percentage is that historically? I mean, does the Attorney General's office have a history of coming down with the big hammer on every case that comes to them? I guess that's kind of what has been alluded to here, and so I'd be curious to see what kind of percentage actually get that $25,000 fine.
Chair Holvey, I think the answer to that is pretty simple. As I just tried to mention in response to Representative Matthews' question, it's very rare that we actually go into court and file a formal complaint and go through the whole process and actually get a court to impose a final penalty, and it's even more rare that we'd actually get $25,000 per violation. The vast, vast majority of the complaints that we look into and take action on result in an assurance of voluntary compliance.
Thank you. I'd still be interested if that data is possible. If it's not, you know, I don't expect you to spend 10 FTEs looking for it. So,
Chair Hovey, we will submit that information to the committee. I think the answer is that less than 1% of cases involve that kind of large $25,000 monetary penalty, but we'll submit that data to you, to the extent that we've got it.
Thank you. And I forgot the second part of my question, so I'll let you off the hook with that one for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Your testimony. Next up, I'd like to have Sybil Head, Angela Martin, and Matt Wallace. Good afternoon.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I'll be happy to start us off, I suppose.
If you can try to keep it, somewhat brief and summarize the best you can. We got several people still left to sign up to speak.
As always, more than happy to keep brief. For the record, my name is Matt Wallace, consumer advocate for OSPIRG. Chair Hovey, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 328 before you today. In terms of new information, I don't have a lot to add. I think that the testimony of the Department of Justice really covered most of the bases, but I do want to weigh in with our support and just emphasize how crucial this sort of legislation is in the tough economic times that we're facing here in the state. As the economic crisis worsens, as we face more people in tough economic situations because of the foreclosure crisis, and now, you know, even new waves of other sorts of kinds of credit where the shoe is starting to drop, such as credit card defaults raising to record levels in January, we know that just more people are behind on their bills, and it's really a very, very important time to watch out and take action on the kinds of practices that that we're seeing documented by written complaints to the Department of Justice and through, you know, just sort of common anecdotal evidence that we hear out there in the community through the work that we do. You've seen the catalog of pretty shocking and abusive tactics that have been increasingly used by the debt collection industry to collect debts, both against people who actually owe a debt, and increasingly, and I think this is a point that was made, against people that may not have anything to do with the debt. And sometimes it's, you know, I guess I won't ask for a show of hands here, but when you walk into a room of about 20 to 30 to 40 people and actually, you know, ask who's gotten a call from a debt collector about a debt they have nothing to do with, you know, usually a significant proportion of those people will raise their hands. And of course, not every one of those calls would be illegal, but it is the case that some of the worst instances of shockingly abusive debt collection practices that you all have, I believe, in your written testimony from DOJ, you know, do involve folks that didn't even owe the debt, who had a similar last name to the debt, who have a similar phone number, you know, live in the house that the debtor used to live in, and so on and so forth. So, again, just to give a little bit of scope and a little bit of perspective of the problem as we see it. And the last thing I just wanted to point out is that, you know, we know there are alternatives under discussion for the ways that we can deal with the debt collection problem. And we view Senate Bill 328 as having some key advantages over alternative approaches, such as, I know we're not on that public hearing yet, but the 2300 that will be addressed later today. But some of the key advantages I think that Senate Bill 328 has is, of course, that it will unequivocally apply to all debt collectors, including first-party collectors and debt buyers, and we view that as a significant advantage. You must, you know, absolutely, to really solve this problem, apply and address the entire market. And then the other thing that was mentioned I think is really important is Senate Bill 328 will allow the Department of Justice to join in these multi-state lawsuits, which is a way for our DOJ and the Attorney General to go after some of the you know, biggest and worst national actors across the country, and we think that's a pretty key mechanism that's present in Senate Bill 328, not present in any alternatives that may be under discussion. And then, of course, there's just the, you know, in addition to the policy advantages that it has, there's just practical advantages, and one is just that Senate Bill 328 would enforce the existing law using existing resources. As you know, of course, it's a one-line bill, which will allow us to enforce those things that are against the law with the resources that we've got now. And again, it's already passed the Senate with 23 aye votes and significant bipartisan support. So I think just from a practical consideration, moving forward on this bill is a good thing to do as well. So that's where I'll leave it for now. In the interest of keeping it brief. So thanks for
Thank you.
Opportunity.
Appreciate it.
Chair,
identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Hulvey, members of the committee, Angela Martin with Our Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 328. Our organization does not provide direct services, unlike Civil Heads organization. People reach out to Oregon Law Center when they need direct legal assistance. People respond to us when they have been so moved that a problem that we identified resonates with them to such a degree that they're going to reach out to us simply to share their story in hope that we can help them change policy. Well, that exact thing happened last week when we sent out an alert asking for our supporters to become aware of this bill and contact the legislators in support of this. A woman named Marion called to share her story with us. I'll keep it brief because it's all too familiar. Her and her husband were both retired, and he was facing kidney disease and eventually passed away from renal failure. In the course of his disease, racked up a tremendous amount of debt, much of it going onto their credit cards so that they could stay afloat. They fell behind. Their Social Security income was clearly not enough to keep up with that debt and started receiving numerous phone calls from debt collectors. The phone calls came at all hours of the night. The phone calls would not stop despite their repeated requests that they stop. And they continued after her husband's death and picked up in volume. She explained that she was threatened with both civil and criminal action, told that someone was going to come out and arrest her if she didn't pay these bills. Clearly, she needed some place to turn to help her enforce the laws that are very clearly spelled out in Oregon law. And that's what's lacking, and that's what Senate Bill 328 would do for us. I'm going to speak briefly to enforcement. The rules guiding enforcement of a law are as important as the substantive policy. The enforcement mechanisms, as we've heard in Oregon's Unlawful Debt Collection Act, have two deficiencies. First, the only enforcement available under current law is an ineffective consumer right of action. Second, there's no state enforcement for even the most egregious violations. Under current law, consumers may pursue action against a company that has violated the law. However, the risk is too great that a consumer seeking redress before a judge may be liable to pay the attorney fees for both sides. I mention this because it's important for us to understand that while Senate Bill 328 fixes an important piece of the enforcement, it does not fix the complete lacking piece that's lacking in enforcement under this law. Placing an undue risk on a victim seeking justice serves as a deterrent to enforcement, thereby shielding aggressive debt collectors who break the law. More on that down the road when you get to consider Senate Bill 386. The private enforcement alone, as I mentioned, will not address the entire problem, and it will not address the large number of small injustices that collectively represent a systemic problem. Currently, no agency is charged with enforcing the policy Oregon lawmakers have already passed, and that's what we seek to have happen with Senate Bill 328. I want to speak quickly to the industry proposal that has been suggested. This proposal comes with a price tag attached and offers fewer protections against the most egregious actors. Often with larger cases involving instances of widespread illegal action by a national company, state AGs will join a suit filed by another AG in another state. If the prosecuting attorney general wins, consumers in all of the states that join the case receive just compensation. Under current law and under the industry proposal that you'll be taking under consideration, Oregonians would continue to be left out in the cold when it comes to multi-state settlements against illegal debt collection actions. All of this for a bill that carries a higher price tag. granting the Attorney General authority to enforce a law would benefit consumers and also benefit debt collection agencies who currently abide by our law every single day. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center here today in support of Senate Bill 328. Appreciate your time today. And I think I echo the comments of those who have gone before me. I think I have two pieces to add. As you all know, I work for the Oregon Law Center. We represent low-income people. We are, unfortunately, pretty much the only access to justice for the lowest-income people in civil legal matters. We are forced to turn away 2 out of every 3 of our eligible clients because we simply don't have enough staff. And so there are many clients who go with many clients who would like to be clients who go without legal assistance and legal resources, even though they may have very viable cases. And for those people who are unable to bring a private right of action to enforce against abusive practices that are already prohibited by the law, this bill would provide some relief. It would provide some access to justice for those who cannot take action on their own. And so we're very supportive of the provisions that Senate Bill 328 will provide to allow the state to really target those repeated rogue, really horrible violators, and to send a message to a standard of practice for the state. And so I guess the only other thing that I would add is that from our experience, and we're representing people who are the lowest income, the most vulnerable, seniors, people with disabilities, these are the people for whom an abusive phone call in the middle of the night is an extraordinary and horrible event. If someone calls me in the middle of the night or in the evening and says inappropriate things or threatens me, I'm not affected in nearly the same way as an elderly woman or a person with disabilities or someone who is low income and facing and just not able to seek access to remedies. And so this bill allows the state to really take a stance against those practices for the most vulnerable people, and we appreciate your attention to it.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Krieger.
It's Angela, is it? Do you know the story that you're telling us about the old couple and getting lost her husband? Do you know where that call came from? Was it from an Oregon-based company or an out-of-state-based company?
Chair Holvey, Representative Krieger, I'd be happy to get you that information. She responded to us via email and then called us directly. Our communications director has that information. I'd be happy to tell you which district and where she's living and what type of company.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? I have one for you, Ms. Hebb. Speaking about the under current law, they do have a private right of action, and I think you mentioned, as well as Ms. Martin mentioned, that you know, there's a deterrent to a private consumer going forward with that because they may lose the case, and then they'd have to pay fees. And is there, how would a consumer go about, I guess, short of coming to a legal aid profession like yours, do they have the ability to just go to a private attorney and hire an attorney to take their action?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, anyone can go to see a private attorney, but the barriers to people with serious income restrictions are huge. Many people charge a fee even just to meet with a person, and even if someone is able to come up with those resources, the ability to follow through with costs along the way, it's impossible. Some attorneys will take cases on a pro bono basis, and we work very closely with individuals who donate their time, but they're simply not enough to satisfy the need. And otherwise, a consumer working with a private attorney who's not working pro bono faces the very great threat of having to pay attorney's fees if to their attorney and potentially to the other side should they lose. So it's a great barrier, and it's a great injustice to individuals who have been so mistreated if that goes unaddressed. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Other questions? I appreciate your testimony today. Thank you very much. Next up, I have Jim Marquis. I also have a Cindy Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association. In starting out, I want you to know that we are opposed to Senate Bill 328 as it is currently written. However, I believe that Attorney General Kroger and my association have the same goals in mind in terms of bringing more regulation to debt collection activity in this state. I want to give you a little history. I've represented the Oregon Collectors Association for 33 years in this building, and the members of their legislative committee today that meet in my office a couple times a month are the sons and daughters of people who hired me. It makes me feel old. I believe that the Oregon-based companies that are in our association, less than 80, by the way, are very responsible people, and they try to do the right thing. Do they make mistakes? Yes. But do they intentionally set out to harm a debtor through violations of the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act? No. We have had in this state for many, many years a law that requires collection agencies to be registered with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And that was in place long before the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act was even written in this state. And I know that because I helped write the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act in this state. The legislature enacted the 646, 639, the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, following the enactment of federal legislation, which said almost exactly the same thing, but that only applied to third-party debt collectors, that is, collection agencies. We enacted the Oregon Act and wrote it so that it applied to everyone collecting a debt. The federal act is, our collection agencies continue to be regulated under the federal act, and it is administered by the Federal Trade Commission. Also regulated under the federal act are debt buyers that were referred to by the Department of Justice as totally unregulated. That's not quite accurate, because they are regulated under the federal act, as are attorneys who are engaged in debt collection activity as a business. So the Oregon Act, however, again, applies to everyone, and the remedy that was put into the Act by the legislature when it enacted it is a right of private action for $200 or actual damages, together with attorney fees, costs and disbursements, and punitive damages. That, I believe, probably served us pretty well for a long time. Over the years, we've become more global, and the world gets smaller, and barriers like state lines and county lines come down. In 2001, this body enacted a very important piece of legislation, which probably nobody thought was very important at the time. We have a statutory provision in Chapter 697, the Licensing Act for Collection Agencies, that says in order to do business in Oregon as a collection agency, you have to have an office here, open regular business hours. You have to keep a trust account here in Oregon. You have to have all of your records have to be kept in Oregon. And for years, as that was the law of the land, we had less than 200 collection agencies registered in the state of Oregon, never exceeded that. 2001, the legislature adopted language in the statute that allowed Department of Consumer Business Services to waive that requirement for an out-of-state collection agency if they deemed it to be appropriate. We didn't oppose that. DCBS then adopted rules as to when they would waive that requirement. And basically, if you were out of state and you posted a little higher bond, you could get the office requirement, et cetera, waived. Following that, in 2001, we went from about 200 collection agencies to 760 collection agencies registered in the state of Oregon today. Most of those new agencies are out-of-state agencies. Over the same period, guess what? Complaints started to rise. And we went from a very small number of complaints to a larger number. Now, the Attorney General's office today testified that it was 1,088 complaints on debt collection in 2008. The listing of complaints that they gave me totaled about 800, so there may be some difference there relative to first-party debt collectors versus third. I'm not sure. They also said that about 75% of their complaints are on out-of-state collection agencies. Our review of the documents provided to us by them indicate that it is more like 90% of the complaints come on out-of-state collection agencies. In 2006, our association did a fairly extensive review of where those complaints came from, and we actually obtained copies of a lot of complaints from the Attorney General's office and reviewed them. In that year, our members had less than 60 complaints out of over 600 filed with the Attorney General's for that office for that year. And that was 60 complaints. We then surveyed our company as to how many debtor contacts our members actually had in that year, Oregon-based companies, and it approached 2.5 million debtor contacts. I would submit to you 60 complaints on 2.5 million contacts, pretty good record. I'd put that against anybody. However, we continue to have problems with complaints, and some of them are egregious, as indicated here. Some of them are less than egregious. Some of them are nothing more than somebody upset that they got a phone call they didn't want to get, or I've looked at, we're required to send a validation notice when we get an account assigned under federal law. I've seen complaints that said, complained that they got a validation notice. Complaints that say, I told them I didn't have the money and they wanted me to pay anyway. Those kinds of complaints that don't rise to this egregious level. Other complaints, simple mistakes, somebody under the Oregon Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, somebody, we're prohibited from contacting a person at their place of employment more than once per week. And only then, you call once per week, but only after you've attempted in good faith to contact the debtor at his place of residence between the hours of 6 and 9 p.m., et cetera, et cetera. And some of these things are a little more technical in nature than just fraudulent activity. And I guess that's what has concerned our members a little bit is how will the Attorney General treat these complaints and will they be subject to potential $25,000 civil penalties for a simple mistake. The Oregon Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act has a willful standard, so you have to willfully violate the law. However, the courts have construed willful is much different than intentional. Willful includes ordinary negligence. If you should have known better and you did it, sorry, it's a violation. I'm somewhat amused. There was some conversation here about the letters that the Attorney General sends alleging that, knowing that they don't have really much enforcement power, but saying, well, we do have this unconscionable tactic authority, and this might rise to the level of unconscionable tactics. Some of my members have received such letters and about things that clearly wouldn't rise to the level of unconscionable tactics. One of the things in the unlawful debt collection practices that it would be a violation is for a collection agency to threaten or imply that they're going to take any action that they don't intend to take or they wouldn't normally take in the normal course of business. Were the Attorney General held to the same standard, he'd be in violation of the law. So I'm somewhat amused by that. But because of the number of complaints and because of the number of out-of-state collection agencies that are here doing business, we think it is time for the state to have more oversight of this activity. The Department of Consumer Business Services has never been given direct authority to enforce this activity, nor do they have specific authority to revoke a license, Representative Hovey, because you asked this question earlier, and I don't think the answer was clear. They do not have specific authority to revoke a license for violation of the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act under present law. So the only question left for us is, and I believe for you, is where should the regulatory oversight be? Should it be with the Attorney General under the Unfair Trade Practices Act, which does carry civil penalties of up to $25,000 per violation, or does it more appropriately belong under the Licensing Act? And we believe that it belongs under the Licensing Act. Now, the Department of Justice has testified today that there would be a fiscal impact at the Department of Consumer Business Services, but there would be no fiscal impact at the Department of Justice. I would submit to you that no matter who is following up and doing the investigation, it's going to cost somebody some money someplace. And so what we have proposed through amendments to House Bill 2300, and I know I'm testifying on 328, but I want you to understand what the alternative that the industry is that our Oregon collection agencies are suggesting would be to amend House Bill 2300 using the -2 amendments to give the Department of Consumer Business Services direct authority to enforce violations by collection agencies of the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, both to allow them to restrict, condition, or suspend registration under the Act, adding restricting or conditioning, because when they waive these in-state offices, they may want to put some restrictions on the license. Civil penalty authority, cease and desist, and, of course, revocation and suspension of license. We believe that the Department of Consumer Business Services can effectively regulate this activity, and we think that they will do so in an even-handed manner. It was pointed out by the Department of Justice that the Department of Consumer Business Services supports Senate Bill 328. I've attached to my written testimony a letter from Department of Consumer Business Services to Senator George dated February 17th, in which Ms. Streisinger has indicated that she would also support the activity being under DCBS if that is the direction the committee chose to go. So I don't think that they're fighting over this and that this is some jurisdictional battle here, but I do think that DCBS has indicated they would support having the authority to enforce this activity. We are somewhat concerned regarding the process by which the Attorney General would proceed in enforcement of this activity. There, under the present practices, I've requested from Mr. Boss written procedures as to how they proceed now on these complaints, and I was told there just simply aren't any written procedures. The issue of debt buyers was raised in this committee both today, but about a month ago I sat on this witness stand and we talked a little about debt buyers. And there's a bill that would exempt debt buyers from the Collection Agency Registration Act statutorily. The Department of Consumer Business Services has said that they probably don't need to be registered under present law now. And frankly, as the law exists today, I testified here 3 or 4 weeks ago that there would be no point to registering them under the present law. But if you choose to have Department of Consumer Business Services regulate debt collection activity for collection agencies, you should probably think about putting debt buyers under the Licensing Act and subject them to the same regulation that they are under the Federal Act, as you should attorneys who are doing debt collection as well. And that would be consistent with federal law. I guess with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. We think that this is just a better mechanism. I attached to my testimony what it would take to for DCBS to do this activity, and we sat down and went through this with them. And they would want three people, so we would have three people full-time doing nothing but debt collection regulation. That would cost about $400,000 a biennium for the regulatory activity. We would pay for that with increased license fees, which roughly $350 to $400 a year. We have talked with the chair of the subcommittee that has the DCBS's budget, Senator Johnson, and she has suggested that while she supported Senate Bill 328 in the House or in the Senate, if this came down to her to make these adjustments, and I think the bill would have to go down there, she would be quite willing to work with DCBS to make those adjustments in the budget and make this work. We think it's a better alternative, and we would urge you to think about moving that direction rather than Senate Bill 328.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, am I correct in assuming that you represent only debt collectors in the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, that is correct.
And there, follow-up? There are approximately 200 of those, am I correct?
There, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I don't know the exact number of Oregon-based companies that are registered as collection agencies. There, our membership in our association is, and I don't have the exact number, but it's less than 80 members, I know. And those are almost all of the Oregon-based collection agencies that are really in the business of doing collections work as a collection agency. The reason I say that is that there are a number of other kinds of companies that are required to be registered as collection agencies, repossession companies, for instance, and some of those things that I don't represent them.
Would you follow up? You represent 80.
Less than 80. I don't know what the exact... Okay. I'll get you the exact number.
Okay.
I don't know what it is.
And if I understand you correctly, your testimony was that the bad actors really are from out of state. Am I correct in remembering that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I believe that 90% of the complaints are on out-of-state collection agencies. Yes, and the complaints that I've reviewed from our members certainly didn't rise to the level of the testimony you heard here today.
Follow-up? So if that's the case, Jim, then why would you be opposed to this bill that would have a heavy hammer on the out-of-state people who really are the bad actors?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, again, we believe that there should be additional regulation. We are very concerned about the $25,000 civil penalty that is out there on the Unfair Trade Practices Act. We are very concerned about the broad authority granted the Attorney General under this act, because you can't have the number of complaints, the number of debtor contacts that our companies have without making a mistake at some point. And under the Federal Act, the Federal Trade Commission, it's an absolute defense if you made a bona fide error. The Oregon Act has no such provision. So we worry about somebody making a mistake. For instance, if you had a company with a debt collector working an account, and they called the place of employment of the debtor to talk to the debtor, that would, if they'd gone through all of the hoops that they needed to do beforehand, that would be legal. If they went on vacation, for instance, and another debt collector were working that file, and there was a failure to note the file properly that the person had already been contacted once at the place of employment this week, and there was a second contact, that's technically a violation. And So we're concerned about people just legitimately making a mistake when they are all located here. And I would say in a meeting with Department of Justice staff, when we ask Mr. Boss, Fred Boss, how they would go about chasing down somebody in Chicago or New York who was a violator, he looked at us and myself and my client sitting around the table, and he said, well, you know, that's a problem.
But that's if a problem. I can interrupt, Jen, the law is a pretty simple law. It's 21 lines, and it says if a person engages, but this is already in law, a person engages in unlawful practice, no mistakes there. And line 8 employs any unconscionable tactic. I mean, that doesn't, am I reading the right law? Right? Senate Bill 328?
Mm-hmm.
That seems pretty simple. And it seems like what you're saying is the people, your 80 members, are pretty good people. And they might make a mistake, but they're probably not going to do an unlawful practice or employ an unconscionable tactic. So I'm still having trouble understanding your not liking this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, what you don't see in Senate Bill 328, it says employs a collection practice that is unlawful under 646-639. You need to open the ORS to 646-639. That appears in line 19 of Senate Bill 328. And this is the act here. And there are lots of things in here about what you can and can't do in the collection of a debt. And I'm saying that they're not all based on fraudulent activity. There are things in here that you can make a mistake in doing. And I'd be happy to furnish you a copy of the statute.
I've got it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the National Association of Credit Management here in Oregon. I've already passed out testimony on their behalf, and I've also sent to many of you via email a list of exactly who NACM is, why they don't support this bill, and what our membership is made up of throughout Oregon. We actually have 970 corporate members, and of those, we received almost $5,000 collection claims last year, worth about $12.6 million to Oregon companies. You've heard some of the certified smart stuff that comes from Mr. Marquis and some of the legal stuff. Our concern is more just on the common sense. Human error happens. And for us, it happened 12 years ago. We've never had a complaint against our collectors, but 12 years ago, we did have a human error that could have cost us big time. And we're concerned that this bill has the potential of exploiting human errors made by otherwise law-abiding Oregon companies. 12 years ago, we had an employee send out a letter that used the term interest instead of late fee. Late fee. It should have said you will be charged a late fee. Instead, it said you will be charged interest. This is wrong. You can't say that. As soon as it was realized, we took full responsibility. We fixed the mistake. We sent you documentation. We sent apologies. We did everything we had to do to make sure the court action did not occur. We corrected this mistake ourselves immediately and thoroughly. Senate Bill 328 would make a subject to massive inquiry and huge fines for such a mistake. There's no protection in this legislation for proactive, self-directed resolution. There is only punishment, and that means more liability insurance for us, and it means higher prices for our members. I ask you this, if a letter from the AG stops this behavior, as he said it does, why do we need more?
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, I'll pass.
Any other questions?
I
appreciate Representative Widener.
Just a real quick one. Jim, have you seen the FairDebtCollection.com or looked at their website, and it lists all the different state rules and regulations? Because it looks like they've drawn out a lot of this stuff, and I'm reading some of it, and it looks similar to what you have in 2300.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I am not familiar with that website. I'm sorry.
So, I think as a committee, it'd probably be worth us taking a look at. They have all the different state statutes, and we're pretty tight on a lot of stuff on some debt collection issues, but some of the stuff we're off a little bit. But it appears to be very informational for us.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
That was really a question, maybe a statement that they get asked. After listening to all this, we talk about the 1,088 complaints. I don't understand how many of that 1,088 were actually complaints about the conduct was bad, where they may not want to even get a letter or a phone call from anybody. And that counts as a complaint. But how many of the 1,088 were of these egregious type things that we've heard about? I am concerned about that.
Mr. Chair.
If you're talking about 15 or 20, then I don't think we need to go to where this 328 goes. But if it's a high percentage, then we got to get... I still think, from listening to this, that the AG and this man need to get together. It's doable. It's fixable. We need to force them to come together and give them their marching orders.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, in response to what I believe there might have been a question in there somewhere.
I don't know the number.
I didn't hear the question. The number of complaints actually equals the number of contacts. So what we've been told at the Department of Justice is that if they get a contact, it goes down as a complaint. There isn't any resolution in the file anywhere because they don't really pursue them other than apparently writing a letter. So we actually talked to the Better Business Bureau and asked them if we got all of the complaints for 2007, and would they go through them and kind of try to do exactly what you're suggesting be done. Unfortunately, the Department of Justice wanted about $7,000 to provide us with the complaints for that year, and I'm not going to say that's, I mean, if that's what it costs, that's what it costs, I guess, but our association just simply didn't have the wherewithal to write a $7,000 check. Otherwise, you'd have that information.
Representative Wingard.
Jim, I'm just curious as to your opinion. If we required anybody who wanted to collect debt in Oregon to get a license, so if Sears wanted to do it in-house, they had to get a license, and if a debt buyer out there, if you're going to collect a debt, you have to get a license. It seems like it would bring a lot of people into the licensure umbrella, and I'm wondering if you think that the license fee would cover the cost, because I saw in some of this that the DCBS was suggesting it might take three more employees. I'm just wondering if there's talk about it there being a fiscal impact, and I'm just wondering if the just sheer number of people who would have to buy a license in order to collect debt would cover the cost of that. And then that, of course, would allow DCBS to pull anybody's license if they are not collecting the debt according to the rules in the law, and that person would simply be unable to collect the debt. They'd have to turn it over to a reputable outfit who does have a license.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, while you have a lot of good ideas, certainly that might not be one of them. I'm not sure that's doable, because every little company out there at some point who engages with consumers has somebody in their office that makes a collection call or whatever, and I'm not sure we could license the number of people I just think it might be undoable to try to license everybody that does any kind of debt collection at all. Although, you know, if you required it to be turned over the day after it became due, that to my guys, that we'd like that, but I doubt that would.
Jim, we're trying to raise revenue around here.
I know. Yeah. I know.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
You have a lot more people coming to testify.
We do, and we do have one other bill that I did want to go through.
Okay, that's okay. Thanks.
Well, that's okay. If you do have a question.
Well, it's actually of Cindy. Cindy, you talked about after a complaint is lodged, it can be enforced by third-party action in a court of law. And as we heard, some of the concerns, especially some of the older people or disabled people who are getting these calls day and night, And I think of my mother, and she certainly, this would be very upsetting if there were to happen to her. She certainly would not be able to take somebody to a court. So I guess I would pose this question to the two of you. It sounds like the people you represent are the good actors, and it seems like you're saying that 90% of the complaints are coming from out of state. I just still have a hard time understanding why you wouldn't support legislation that would help get rid of the bad actors from out of state and not force my mother and other people who would find it very difficult to take someone to court.
Right. Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, and perhaps in the anticipation of what Representative Barton had on the tip of his tongue, let me assure you that NAC and Morgan does not want to have these bad actors around. We pride ourselves on not being one of the bad actors, and we all have grandmothers too, and we don't want this to happen to them. The problem is clearly that we need to find some way to make sure that everyone abides by the values and the morals and the rules that we think work, and that's through licensure. There's nothing worse in our business than getting your license taken away. Mm-hmm. Some companies you can even fine, but there's nothing worse than getting your license taken away. So all the businesses doing business in Oregon should be licensed and be residents of Oregon. And finally, you're right. This is a bill that helps to keep the bad actors away, and we have an excellent new Attorney General, and in the past we had a very good Attorney General. But the fear on some of my members' part is that someday we'll be in more economic problems and we won't have people who want to be as fair about the unwilling accidental call and maybe fine people more than they can absolutely afford.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I don't want anybody on this committee to have any impression that we are against additional regulation. I started my testimony by saying that. We believe it is time for consumers to have some place to go. The only question is, where do they go? And we think it belongs under the Licensing Act, not under the Attorney General's Act. I want to be very clear about that.
Okay, Representative Riley.
I'd like your response to this comment, if you could. I've looked at a lot of things. I've been on this committee for two sessions now, and I've seen a lot of places where there are licensing requirements, where a company, a bad acting company in some business, usually we're talking about code violation kinds of things, builders, whatever, but license gets pulled. Tomorrow there's a new company. And they have a license. And there's nothing that anybody can do about it. What's your response to that?
To the extent that, Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, to the extent that that is a problem, and I don't know that it has been in this area, but to the extent that it is, it wouldn't matter if the regulation were under the Attorney General's office or under the licensing authority. That would be a problem either way, I believe, if that is indeed a problem.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, there is actually a bill right now up in one of the judiciary committees that deals with that, and I'd be happy to get that number and pass it along to you and see if that actually answers your questions.
I would appreciate it.
Yeah,
that.
I just
you.
Saw it. So.
Yeah, I appreciate your testimony. I just have a couple of comments. You know, I understand, you know, your concern of the heavy-handed regulation under the UTPA. But, you know, I think as was testified, almost all of our industries fall under the UTPA, except for collection agencies, insurance, and mortgage lending, I think, were the ones that were testified to. So, you know, and I just... And in relationship to that heavy hand, I don't know that there's a history of the Attorney General, you know, coming down with, you know, these huge hammers that you speak of as far as the $25,000 fine for making a mistake or an error. So I and that's why I asked for that information from the Attorney General's office. So maybe that'll help shed some light on that. And in defense of Representative Wingard, before he suggested licensing first-party collectors, he did wait till Mr. Martinez was out of the room.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your comments, and thank you for defending Representative Wingard. I do, at the risk of bringing your wrath on me, I want to correct you because
Are you sure?
Repeated something, yes. You've repeated something the Department of Justice said, and that is that collection agencies are exempt from the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and they're not exempt from the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. They're under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, just like every other company is, for everything that is regulated under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act.
I think the issue is the unlawful debt collection practices are not enforceable under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. So
that is an important distinction in my mind, Representative Colby. Thank you.
Thanks for the distinction.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony today. Up next, I have Paul Cosgrove. Who may or may not be willing to license the first-party collectors.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove. I represent the Oregon Financial Service Association, but I'm appearing on behalf of my colleague who left the room, Mr. Martinez, who is in a member's office in a meeting, but we are both here on behalf of the United Financial Lobby, which is the organization of all the regulated state chartered and licensed financial institutions in opposition to SB 328, and some brief bullet points of why we are in opposition are being passed out now. I'd just like to make a couple of comments to expand on those bullet points, and I recognize the time is drawing nigh, so I'll try to be brief, and then I'll be happy to answer questions. You heard from the Attorney General's office that there is no state agency that is able to enforce the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, and that may be somewhat true generally, but it's most certainly not true for regulated financial institutions. All of our lending practices are subject to the oversight of the Department of Consumer Business Services currently, under our current licenses. So if, as the Chair pointed out, Representative Winger waited until Mr. Martinez left about licensing first-party debt collectors, we are licensed and subject to the enforcement, including civil penalties, consumer refunds, cease and desist orders, all of the kinds of remedies that the Attorney General would have are already in existence with respect to our institutions in the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And then the second issue I'd like to point out is just to sort of a brief correction to the record. No lending activities of any financial institutions, including mortgage lending, but far beyond that, are under the purview of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, nor are the activities of insurers under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And that is because, first, as a matter of the legislature's own enactment with respect to the insurance industry, and because of court cases dating back to 1973 and recently reaffirmed by more recent decisions, the courts and the legislature have assumed that the kind of comprehensive licensing and regulation of financial institutions that exists in DCBS and its predecessor agencies was appropriate not to be duplicated under unlawful trade practices. So unlawful trade practices does not apply to our lending activities. It can apply to other kinds of activities that a lender does, and there have been cases on that. As you know, financial activities, financial institutions now engage sometimes in other kinds of activities other than lending. But for their lending activities, that's under the purview of DCBS. And we are audited and reviewed regularly and consistently by DCBS to make sure that we're in compliance with all of the legal requirements that apply to us, including Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. So we would appreciate you recognizing that there is already a solution, there is already a state agency with the authority, the ability, and the willingness to enforce the act against our particular interests, and that's the reason for our opposition to Senate Bill 328. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Not seeing any, appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
This is the key right here.
Next up, I have Keith Carnes. And
that's the Krieger key.
That looks like it.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. My name is Keith Carnes. I'm a private attorney here in Oregon. I represent consumers throughout Oregon and somewhat Washington. I think I have the distinction of being the one who's brought the most private rights of action under the fair debt collection laws in the state in the last 5 years. I sue more debt collectors
than anyone, according to one federal judge I've spoken to. And there's a few issues that I'd like to point out regarding Senate Bill 328. First, the United States Code and the Supreme Court's attempt, or the Supreme Court's interpretation of it, makes it very clear that federally chartered banks and their subsidiaries are not to be licensed, or they cannot be required to register in a state, and the state cannot monitor its debt collection activities, or its licensure requirements. The Supreme Court has made that clear, and so to the extent that national banks are, such as Citibank and the like, are engaging in collecting their own debts, there's no one in the state who can license them, revoke their license, or penalize them in any way unless it deals with their debt collection. And so revoking a license obviously would not be a solution when we consider that national banks and their subsidiaries, including those who do vehicle loans and the like, is beyond the purview of the state. Each day I speak to consumers, and I'd like to tell you just a few of their stories and in support of this bill. You know, I had a client who was recently divorced, and she was living off of substantial income from her husband. During the pendency of the divorce, she didn't really have any ability to make money because her nursing license had gone inactive. One day, she received a debt collection call from an outside, you know, a debt collector in Massachusetts, saying, "Is this Miss Jones?" "Yes, we're calling from the hospital. One of your coworkers has been in a serious accident, is about to die, and he asked that we give you a call." And she said, "Okay, which hospital?" He says, "Is this Mrs. Jones from ABC Corporation?" No, "I work at XYZ Corporation." "Well, that's all we need. Thanks for your help. Goodbye." They immediately began garnishing her wages. This was their trick to find out where she worked. My client later, we filed suit, and we got an agreeable settlement. We got the debt paid for through the settlement and the like. My client later contacted me and told me that between the divorce and the fact that her life had become nothing more than a joke to some debt collectors, she decided it was time to kill herself. And it was only when she felt like she had someone on her side that she felt that she could keep going on. Thank you. I had another client whose name is Beverly. She owed some money to Sears, but she became disabled through a car accident, and she had a letter from an insurance carrier saying that her disability insurance had paid the account in full. When Sears sold off its credit arm to Citibank, somehow Citibank began collecting this card. Again, Citibank cannot be regulated through DCBS. And they actually started calling her so frequently that it became a problem, especially on the day that her son turned blue and fell over in front of her. She wheeled, she wheeled her electronic wheelchair to the phone only to have Citibank on the line, and she preventing her from calling 911. She explained to them that she needed to call for help for her dying son and hung up the phone. Of course, Citibank called back before she could pick up the phone again and call 911. She was forced to wheel her chair to the neighbor's house through the rain just to call help for her dying son. Of course, not all the people I speak to have such terrible incidents happen to her, but many of the in-state debt collectors engage in unlawful collection attempts. I had one client who is named Maria Gomez. A debt collector in town sent in a garnishment to her employer, and they responded back by saying, "This is an R. Maria Gomez. She has a different middle initial, and she has a different Social Security number." The debt collector promptly changed the Social Security number and the name on the garnishment and resubmitted it, hoping that the employer would garnish my client, despite the fact that they had a judgment against a person with a similar name. I have another client who actually did attempt to commit suicide, and she got her life back on track. When she was 17, she found out she was pregnant. And then she started getting calls at work. She worked her way up to be an assistant manager at Carl's Jr. She was getting calls at work so many times that she was actually going to get fired from her job because this one local debt collector right down the street kept calling her so often. We see one debt collector in particular who will collect on anybody with a similar name. They'll file lawsuits, they'll issue garnishments, they will call mercilessly anybody who has a name similar to that of our client. We see this again and again. I had a client who, a rent-to-own company, threatened to kill her and burn her house down if she didn't return the television that she had. I had a client who brought to me a letter from his boss saying, if I get one more call at my house regarding your debt, I'm going to fire you. I have one client who reported that a debt collector showed up at her house with her small children with a gun. Another said that her husband owed a bill before he left her alone with her three children. And the debt collector called a neighbor, which was a registered sex offender, and sent the sex offender to the house saying, you need to start calling this bill collector back. I have hundreds and hundreds of people who report they receive calls at work, threats of criminal prosecution, but every day, I'm sorry, not every day, but over the last few years, I've literally turned away hundreds and hundreds of cases because I can only do so much. There aren't very many attorneys who are willing to take on these collection cases. I encourage folks to do it, and they all say to me the same thing. Well, how am I going to get paid? Your client, you know, these people don't have any money. I take them on pro bono, and I get recoveries under the UDCPA sometimes, but this just isn't enough, the private right of action. I agree that people should pay back their money, the money that they borrow, and debt collectors have plenty of remedies to do that. They can sue people, and they can recover their attorney fees and court costs to do so. They can file an involuntary bankruptcy for somebody who refuses to pay their money. There's plenty of opportunity for debt collectors to collect the money without engaging in abuse and fraud and interfering with people's ways of life. I had one client who called me recently and told me that she had recently gone through Alcoholics Anonymous and had graduated. Once her debt collector started threatening to throw her in jail, she started drinking again. She reported that to the debt collector and said, it's okay, when you're in jail, you have plenty of time to dry up. These are the type of things that I hear literally on a daily basis. We need some regulation from the state to step in and stop this type of abuse, and licensure just will not do it. Many national banks who are now feeling the crunch of the Financial Times themselves are engaging in more and more oppressive and offensive ways of collecting debts, and DCBS absolutely can do nothing about that. Only their collection activities can be regulated by the state, and I believe the Department of Justice would do that well. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I just have one question for you, and it has to do with the federal institutions and subsidiaries that we don't regulate at the state or can't take action on their practices. Does and it's my understanding the federal government does regulate them and as well as their practices. What's your, and correct me if I'm wrong about that, but what's your experience with getting action from the federal government on these issues?
Well, my experience, I monitor this, and the FDIC routinely turns out a report once a year that says we receive no complaints about any of our institutions about how they collect debts. None. I mean, that's what they're doing. If you're being harassed by a debt, I wouldn't think, I would now, but most people aren't thinking, I'm going to call the FDIC and complain. You know, they're going to call someone local here. And so the FDIC is not really, or the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, or those who deal with credit card banks, are routinely reporting that they have no complaints whatsoever. I occasionally direct my clients to file complaints, including with the Attorney General. I tell them they have no jurisdiction to do anything, but feel free if you want to complain to somebody, tell them. But there's really nothing that's being done on the federal level to deal with the credit card banks and the like.
And what about the FTC?
The Federal Trade Commission has jurisdiction over debt collectors, credit reporting agencies, and the like. However, I don't believe they have regulation over the collection practices of nationally chartered banks. I believe that just goes to the institution that regulates the banking itself. I can check on that and report back if you'd like.
Thanks. Well, you certainly have seen a lot of cases that give us pause. I appreciate your testimony. Are there any other questions for Mr. Carnes at this point? I'm not seeing anything. Thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill or Senate Bill 328 and open a hearing on House Bill 2300. And Mr. Marquis. Did I miss something?
Mr. Chair, before you gavel down, I tried to get up and rectify an error. Cindy Robert, NACM, Oregon.
On the test.
No, can't do it. It's
reopen.
I'm sorry. No.
I'll reopen hearing on Senate Bill 328. So go ahead.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I just hate to leave the wrong impression with words that were chosen. In the testimony, the written testimony you received from NACM Oregon, in the fourth paragraph, it says, in the current system of regulation under the Unfair Debt Collection Practices Act, a complaint is lodged, investigated by DCBS, and enforced by third-party action. Mincing of words, we only have investigation for our business practices, not for our debt collection practices. And third-party action is for the collection practices, not the business practices. So that sentence is incorrect. I will send a correction to you. Ben kindly pointed this out to me, that it is a merging of two different types of investigations. So I wanted to clarify that for the record.
Thank you. I'm glad that you came up and did that for us.
And Mr. Chair, while you're still back there on 328, Mr. Unger has complained to me that I apparently said all of the complaints that they have listed are simply contacts, and that they now keep track of that separately, contacts versus complaints. So I'm not sure where that is, and I think you should probably, I want to correct that if that's wrong, but I want to, perhaps you should ask them for that information.
I'd like to close the hearing on Senate Bill 328. Mr. Marquis, would you like to explain House Bill 2300 with your -2 amendment to us?
Yes, please. Mr. Chair. Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association again. House Bill 2300 was actually introduced at the request of the Oregon Collectors Association relating to collection agencies. It was, as introduced, really an attempt to require DCBS to be a little more cautious in terms of waiving out-of-state agencies office requirements, in-state office requirements for out-of-state agencies. We have had -2 amendments drafted, and they would bring regulation of debt collection activity for collection agencies under the Licensing Act in Chapter 697. They would allow the department to restrict or condition a license in addition to suspending or revoking. We believe that restricting or putting conditions on license might be appropriate where in-state offices have been waived for out-of-state collectors. The under this provision, the department would have authority for cease and desist. They would have authority for civil penalties for violations of anything under 697, but also for violations of 646, 639, which is the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. And additionally, as I stated earlier in my testimony on 328, we believe that this enforcement is more appropriate under the Licensing Act. We believe that DCBS has a track record in terms of enforcing for financial institutions, and in working with them, they would want three new FTEs. We would add those and pay for them with our licensing fees in Ways and Means Committee, as we described in Senate Bill 328. We think this is simply more appropriate. One more distinction, I guess, that I should mention between this alternative and Senate Bill 328. For years, the Oregon legislature, under regulatory functions that they've created for state agencies, have been careful to ensure that fines and assessments accrue to the general fund of the state of Oregon and not back to the regulatory agency seeking those fines. We do so, and this body has done so for many years, for a very specific reason. You do not want enforcement activity to be budget-driven. And when an agency is short of money, you don't want them to go out and busting somebody just because they need the money. Under amended 2300, fines and assessments would accrue to the general fund. Hence, there is a fiscal impact, $400,000 a biennium. My clients are willing to pay for that $400,000 out of their license fees. So taxpayers in the state of Oregon don't pay for anything. Under the Senate Bill 328, the Attorney General would have enforcement powers under the UTPA. Under the Unfair Trade Practices Act, all fines and assessments accrue directly back to the program, not to the general fund. So I suppose that that may indicate why there's not a fiscal impact, I don't know, on 328. But it is of concern to those who are regulated when the agency assessing fines has the fines accrued directly to the program. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. So if I understand you, Jim, I'm just doing the math here. So you said your folks would be willing to pick up that $400,000. It looks like that would be $5,000 apiece. They're willing to pay that. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, in my testimony on Senate Bill 328, I attached, and I apologize that I didn't give it to you again, but there is attached to my testimony on 328 an outline from DCBS, which shows the fiscal impact. And because there are 760 registered collection agencies licensed in the state, so each one would pay an additional $300.
So it's not just your 80 members?
Oh, no.
Okay,
no,
you had said you represent 80 members, and you said my members.
Less than
so
that.
So I was doing
no,
that.
No,
okay.
I'm willing to pay through increased license fees for all collection agencies. I apologize if I didn't make myself clear.
Thank you.
Follow-up to that?
Representative Tomei?
Do
you want to follow up?
No. Oh. I know. I'm sorry. I didn't say it right. Mr. Chair, I'm asking for a follow-up to Representative Tomei's question.
Got it. Representative
it
Cowan.
My fault.
Representative
sorry about
Cowan.
It is almost. It is 5 o'clock. My brain has gone on.
Yes, it
much.
Is. It's
going to leave in 30 seconds. Mr. Marquis, if 80 or so are your members and there's however many, you said, entities to whom this licensure increase would apply, have you had any means of communicating with them? See, I can't talk either. Do you have any means to communicate with those other entities to find out how they'd feel about the license fee increase? Who are not your members?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelman, are you referring to the out-of-state collection agencies that would pay increased license fees?
So there's only, maybe I'm just misunderstanding what you just said, then there's only 80 in-state, and those are the only ones who would pay that increase?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cowan, our membership is less than 80, and I'm going to have to get the exact number. I think it might even be less than 70 now because of mergers, et cetera. Those are the bulk of the in-state registered collection agencies domiciled in Oregon. Additionally, there are companies that are required to be registered as collection agencies who aren't really what you and I would think of as collection agencies. They are repossession companies and other kinds of folks that are required to be registered. I believe that the total of companies in Oregon that are actually registered as under the Act approaches 200, but again, I'll have to get those exact figures for you, and I can do that from DCBS, and I'll send that to you by letter or some such means. The rest of the 760 registered collection agencies are domiciled outside of Oregon. So everyone would pay the additional fees. Right now, the fee is $125 or $150 a year for a renewal. It's going to go to about $350 a year, and I would say that's a pretty small price to pay to bring this kind of regulatory function to the state of Oregon. So I haven't talked to the out-of-state collection agencies about that specific thing, but...
I tracked it now. Thank you.
You got it?
Mr. Markey, does House Bill 2300, if it were passed with the Dash 2 amendments, does it do anything as far as regulating the debt buyers or first-party collectors?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I did not include that in the Dash 2, but as I've testified earlier and twice in front of this committee, once today and once 3 weeks ago, I believe that's something the committee should look at very strongly. If you move this direction, I believe that debt buyers, I believe that's a policy consideration for the committee to consider. About putting debt buyers under the Act if you go that direction. It's a growing industry, and they are not presently registered as collection agencies in Oregon.
So you're advocating that if we went this direction, we should register or license debt buyers and first-party collectors?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I stated earlier in my testimony on Senate Bill 328 was that under the federal Act, which primarily regulates third-party debt collectors, that is, collection agencies, and doesn't regulate most first-party debt collectors administered by the Federal Trade Commission. The Federal Act includes third-party debt collectors, which are collection agencies. It includes debt buyers, people who are in the business of buying debt and collecting it, separate and apart from other first-party collectors. And it also includes attorneys who are in the business of collecting debts. So it includes those three entities, and I would suggest that it might be appropriate for the committee to look at putting all three of those entities under the Oregon Licensing Act for collection agencies if you chose to adopt the amendments in 2300.
But you are not advocating for first-party collectors to be under that act as well, then? Yes or no?
Mr. Chair, no. Not beyond debt buyers. And,
yes, that was my question.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Callan.
Thank you. Do we have a position from DCBS on House Bill 2300?
We haven't asked for one.
Okay, thank you.
They are in the room. Representative Winger, question? I think I need to deal with Representative Cowan's question first.
Mr. Chair, if I could, you do have a letter from DCBS in my testimony on Senate Bill 328, which does say that they would support the regulatory function being under DCBS. That does not indicate support for the specific language in the Dash 2 amendments on House Bill 2300. I have spoken with and met more than once with DCBS staff regarding where we would want to go, and I believe that if you decide to go that direction, you would certainly want to get a position on the exact language.
Yes, I know that's somewhat of a qualified letter. I think they have a similar one in support of Senate Bill 328, too. I appreciate your comments. I want to get DCBS up real quick, if I can, to answer Representative Cowan's question.
Mr. Chair, Lou Savage, Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. In answer to Representative Cowan's question, we have not taken a position on House Bill 2300. As Mr. Markey indicated, even with the Dash 2 amendments, we think there are some additional issues that would need to be addressed. We feel strongly that there should be state enforcement of the unfair debt collection statute, and that should be across the board. The Dash 2 amendments do not deal with debt buyers. They also don't deal with first-party debt collectors. And additionally, I've had a conversation with Mr. Markey about the penalty section of of the Dash 2 Amendment, Section 3, the maximum civil penalty, which the Dash 2 Amendment say should not exceed $10,000, is not quite in line with some of our other statutes, particularly because there are a lot of these debt collectors are out of state and national companies. We would want to make sure that whatever fine there is actually a deterrent to bad conduct. I guess related to the debt buyer issue, if in fact the committee chose to go this route, we would expect that 3 FTE would increase, because the 3 FTE estimate was based upon just regulating the debt collectors.
Representative Widener.
Just real quick, Mr. Chair. Just from what I'm going through and after listening to what's transpiring here, and maybe the two of you can help me on this, it appeared that the debt buyers, from what I was looking on a bunch of these different websites, appear to be one of the biggest problems and the most aggressive that are out there and causing a lot of the conflict, and probably DCBS might be better. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, Jim Marquis again. Debt buyers are a problem nationally, and it's a growing industry where creditors, including even government agencies sometimes, have sold debt to people for whatever it is, cents on the dollar, and they go out and try to collect it. I didn't include it in the Dash 2 amendments because we had talked about it in this committee, and there you have a bill before this committee from the Oregon State Bar that goes the opposite direction, and I felt it might be presumptuous of me to put it in my Dash 2 amendments since I don't represent debt buyers or anybody related to them, but I have raised it more than once here that I think it's something you need to look at.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I really don't have anything to add to that. Because we do not enforce the unfair debt collection statute, it is really not the focal point for consumer complaints. So really what you have read is probably about the same information that we have.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Toomey.
Thank you. So, Lou, we heard from an earlier testifier that DCBS cannot enforce anything that is a federally licensed bank or its subsidiary. So would the debt buyers be included in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tilmay, only if they purchased a debt from a federally federally chartered institution.
I'm not sure what you're saying.
Well, a debt buyer purchases a debt from another entity.
Right.
So the federally chartered institution would not be a debt buyer.
Okay, got it. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Lou, can you answer me? Is a debt buyer currently, are they a first party collector?
Representative Holley, I think they probably would be.
Mm-hmm. So if we license them, would not we be licensing first-party collectors?
I think you're probably right on that, Representative Holley, but I'd have to get back to you on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could clarify, there is a definition in the federal law of debt buyer that puts people in the business of buying debts under the federal act, but excludes other first-party debt collectors, and I think what you might want to look at is something similar to that under this act, if you put it under this act.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Wingard,
if I could just add to that, I think it is possible to define the debt buyer as somebody who's purchased a debt that they did not themselves incur and separate them legally from a person who created the debt between them and the customer.
Sure, a lot of things are possible, I'm sure. Any other Representative Matthews?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Point of clarification, I guess, and perhaps we had covered third party and first party. Does House Bill 2300 apply only to third party collections, or will that also apply to first party as well?
I think the answer was it only applies to third party collection agencies.
Okay.
So I had one more question for you, Lou, and I guess it had to do with how many collection agencies are registered in the state of Oregon, how many of them are in-state, and how many are out-of-state.
Well,
do you have that answer?
Mr. Chair, I think I can tell you the total number, and that is, as Mr. Marquis stated, around 760 collection agencies are registered by the division. I don't know that I have the information as to how many are in-state and how many out-of-state, but we can certainly get that information for you.
I would appreciate that. Thank you. If you could follow up with Victoria on that answer instead of me personally. Her memory would be better. I don't see any other questions. Thanks for the testimony. I've got two more people signed up, Keith Devanovich and Sybil Hebb. See if I got it right this time. Welcome. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please, on House Bill 2300.
Thank you, Chair Halvey. My name is Keith Devanovich, Special Counsel for the Attorney General. Members of the committee, we do not support 23-2 amendments for a couple of very brief reasons. First, as the Attorney General indicated, we do in many, many fields get involved in multi-state enforcement actions against companies that might be in New York or Florida or Kansas City. And the 2300 bill would not alter that situation. We couldn't do that against foreign out-of-state debt collectors. So our hands would still be tied. I can assure the committee that the Department of Justice has no problems whatsoever going against out-of-state companies. As a lawyer who had practiced for 25 years representing a lot of businesses, I can assure you that I had a lot of clients that were companies outside the state of Oregon that the Department of Justice was able to find. So that is definitely not a reason to not give enforcement powers to the Department of Justice. It is not a concern that we have that we can't chase after out-of-state companies. As it has been indicated, the Dash 2 amendments have a substantial fiscal impact. On the other side of the aisle, the Senate Minority Report had an analysis of 262,000 and somewhere around 300 in the 2011 biennium and about 350 for the following biennium. I'm certainly not good with math, but at least if I do a little rounding and assume that it's going to cost $400,000 and that there are 800 licensees, that's $500 per licensee on an annual basis, or biannual basis, I guess it is. Now, in my view, why should we be charging companies that are complying with the law more to be able to do business in the state? Why wouldn't we be imposing that additional cost upon those companies that are violating the law? Well, the 2003-2 amendments, unfortunately, pass on the cost of enforcement to companies that are complying with the law. And in my view, that doesn't make any sense. And last but not least, the Dash 2 amendments, as we've heard, have no impact on debt buyers or debt collectors. And even if the Dash 2 amendments were passed, DCBS cannot terminate their license because they're unlicensed entities. So in essence, the debt collectors and debt buyers would be allowed to continue to violate the law, and there would be no enforcement against those entities, even if the Dash 2 amendment to 2300 was passed. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Hebb?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center. I want to go on record as stating that I think ideally the Oregon Law Center
would like to see a spectrum of enforcement remedies available to make sure to hold up the appropriate standards for all debt buyers. And in our minds, that would contemplate a three-pronged approach, one of which we currently have under current law with the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, which gives rise to a private right of action, the second of which is embodied in Senate Bill 328, which allows the state the authority to enforce against egregious and repeat violators of these standards when individuals are unable to do so for themselves. And the third would be some form of administrative regulation, such as is contemplated potentially by House Bill 2300. However, we're not supportive of House Bill 2300 with the Dash 2 amendments as it's written, and I'll tell you why. Unfortunately, we think it's impractically drafted, and it doesn't provide protective relief or remedy against the people and the full spectrum of people that we're worried about. Number one, it's expensive. Even if we could find a way to pay for it, it wouldn't actually provide oversight and underlying authority to regulate all debt collectors, as has been outlined previously. Debt buyers would not be regulated, and they are, in fact, one of the largest problems that we hear about. And so it's not appropriate in our minds to leave them out. Also, the penalties that are proposed under House Bill 2300 are arbitrarily capped, and they are not dollars that go to remedy the consumers for the injuries that they have suffered as a result of the violations. And so while an administrative regulation scheme is a good idea, it's not embodied appropriately in House Bill 2300. Even if we could fix the problems with that particular bill and find a way to pay for that mechanism, it still would not be a substitute for House Bill 328. Because House Bill 328 is the only, or Senate Bill 328 is the only thing that would allow us to get at those out-of-state violators. It's the only thing that would allow us to get at damages for the people who have suffered from the violations, and it's a vital tool in providing accountability against egregious behavior by the whole spectrum of debt collectors, including debt buyers. So, thank you.
Appreciate your comments. Representative Widener.
Real quick, Sybil. Just with the cases that you've dealt with, do you find that debt buyers tend to be the worst of the worst?
Chair Holvey and Representative Widener, members, I don't think that I could make a quantitative analysis there. I think there are certainly egregious behaviors across the spectrum. Most recently, we've seen a rise in the debt buyer complaints, but I think that's because they're a relatively new phenomenon, at least in our experience. But I couldn't tell you statewide where I thought it is.
Thank you.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Keith, help me understand. So 2300, there are 760 people apparently licensed in Oregon that are from out of state, and you're saying this bill would not affect those folks? Is that what I understood?
Chair Holvey, Representative Tomei, it's my understanding that there are 760 entities that are licensed in the state of Oregon to collect debt. 2300-2 appears to apply to them. What it would not apply to is the entities that do not hold a license in the state of Oregon but collect debts here. They may be first-party debt collectors, or they could be debt buyers. They are not presently regulated by DCBS, and under the Dash 2 amendments to 2300, they will continue to not be regulated by DCBS. So they would fall into a gap of no enforcement whatsoever.
Thank you.
Other questions? I don't see any right at the moment. I think we've exhausted our committee on this subject matter for today. I appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much. With that, committee, we've also exhausted the list of people who wanted to testify on this bill. Don't see anybody else jumping up to testify, so I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2300.
I'll see you at the kitchen.
And Wednesday, we have a relatively large calendar, so we will be trying to move through it quickly and efficiently, making sure that we hear all opinions necessary. So I will see you all on Wednesday. With that, I adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.